Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. Taiwanese opposition party leader Tsai Ing-wen claimed a decisive election victory Saturday and is set to become the island's first woman president. Voting results confirmed Tsai's victory over ruling Nationalist Party, or KMT, candidate Eric Chu, who conceded defeat. In victory remarks, Tsai of the Democratic Progress Party signaled she would promote Taiwan's independence while continuing good relations with mainland China. The U.S. quickly congratulated Tsai. State Department spokesman John Kirby said in a statement that we share with the Taiwan people a profound interest in the continuation of cross-strait peace and stability. Tsai will replace President Ma Ying-jeou, who had served 8 years and was constitutionally barred from serving another term. China has not said much about the vote, but has said it will not work with any candidate who does not support the One China principle. Burkina Faso government officials say the siege of an upscale hotel that killed at least 23 people in the capital Ouagadougou has ended. Interior Minister Simon Compaoré said Saturday that the victims from 18 countries died in the attack at the splendid hotel, adding that more than 150 hostages were rescued in a security operation, but a number of them were wounded. Compaoré said that 3 militant jihadists were killed in the attack, 2 women and 1 man. Burkina Faso President Roch-Marc Christian Kabayore, who took office last month, visited the hotel Saturday and called the attack cowardly and vile. Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb claim responsibility for the raid. This is VOA News. Iran said Saturday it is releasing 4 Iranian Americans as part of a prisoner swap. Iranian media report that jailed Washington Post correspondent Jason Rezaian is among them. Iran did not immediately identify the 4 prisoners it is releasing, but Tehran's public prosecutor said the release was in line with orders from the Supreme National Security Council. Rezaian, the newspaper's Tehran bureau chief, holds dual U.S. and Iranian citizenship. He's been in prison for more than 500 days and was convicted last year of espionage in a closed-door trial. Tehran is believed to be holding 3 other Americans, including Amir Hekmati, a former U.S. Marine who was arrested during a family visit to Tehran in 2011, and Saeed Abedini, a Christian pastor arrested in the Iranian capital in 2012 in similar circumstances. Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif says international economic sanctions on Iran will be lifted Saturday, with the United Nations Nuclear Watchdog Agency expected to confirm that Tehran has complied with last July's landmark agreement with world powers to restrain its nuclear development program. The top Iranian diplomat met with the European Union foreign policy chief on implementation of the Iranian nuclear deal negotiated over 2 years among Tehran and the United States, Britain, China, France, Russia, and Germany. In the July 14th pact, Iran agreed to curb its nuclear program in exchange for the lifting of sanctions against Tehran. A U.S. Army report detailing the mistaken shipment of live anthrax over a period of years says failures in leadership and technical processing were to blame. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb reports.
The investigation into the Army's biodefense shipments showed no one person or single event was directly responsible for the mistake, which sent live anthrax to nearly 200 labs in the U.S. and abroad. As Paul Ostrowski, the Army general who led the investigation, puts it,
a combination of events, including gaps in science, institutional issues, and personal accountability, when taken together, each contributed to this event.
That report by correspondent Carla Babb. Indonesian police say they've arrested 12 people allegedly connected to this past week's deadly Islamic State-linked terror attack in the capital. The country's national police chief said Saturday the suspects were arrested in raids across the nation. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
By our statutes, we do not accept any act of terrorism. We have legislation against such acts, and therefore it remains unacceptable.
ECOWAS condemns the terror attacks in Burkina Faso.
This request to open a new investigation into it was instructed by the demand of the Office of the National Security Advisor, who made the request and the President approved it.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari demands fresh investigations into the abducted Chibok schoolgirls.
Well, in this country for some time now, people have been talking about the tribalism and regionalism that emerged.
And Zambian President Edgar Lungu warns members of his ruling party to stop commenting on issues of tribalism. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Economic Community of West African State, ECOWAS, a regional bloc, has sharply condemned the terrorist attack in Burkina Faso that left 23 people dead, including three of the jihadists, and at least 30 injured. Officials say security officers rescued 126 hostages at the Splendid Hotel where the attack took place. Haruna Wakani, a spokesman for ECOWAS, told me the group's officials are monitoring the situation after expressing condolences to President Christian Kabore and the people of Burkina Faso over what he described as a dastardly act of terrorism on a member country.
This is an act that is always condemnable by ECOWAS because by our statutes we do not accept any act of terrorism. We have legislation against such acts, and therefore it remains unacceptable.
Now, looking forward at this act, will the regional bloc be cooperating and coordinating with authorities in Burkina Faso to prevent such future occurrences, particularly when recently Boko Haram has also attacked some countries in the region?
Well, you know, the terrorism is no longer a national issue of any country. It is a regional and global issue, which ECOWAS has always promoted to say we intend to attack such globally because it is difficult to understand why such things could occur. And ECOWAS is doing everything possible to make sure it's mitigated anywhere else in the region.
Well, I understand the officials of ECOWAS are currently monitoring the situation in Burkina Faso to come up with appropriate response in cooperation with the government, in assisting the government in this directive. What can you tell me about this?
Yeah, you are well informed. That is what is currently going on. There will be statements that will be issued shortly and strategies of curtailing such events and perhaps preventing them altogether. Because you see, anything that disrupts the lives of the citizens of the sub-region remains unacceptable. And so vigorous steps are being taken at diplomatic, international and regional levels to ensure that such things don't happen. Second, we intend to strengthen the armed forces and then the security to ensure that such things are nipped in the bud because it's becoming too many at the time.
Recently, there was a push by ECOWAS to ensure member countries are not destabilized by such dastardly act, as you rightly said. Will this attack serve as a rallying call for the countries to be more mindful of such act and to bolster their security to prevent such future occurrences?
Well, as you probably would have known by now, right from the attacks of Boko Haram and Ansar and the rest of them in the sub-region, the member states have been sufficiently galvanized to look at this more as a regional problem rather than national. And that's why you could see, in the case of Boko Haram, for instance, ECOWAS had rallied around Nigeria to ensure that all neighboring countries cooperate very well to ensure some restrictions in movements and the rest of them. Similarly, when the Mali experience occurred, ECOWAS have taken steps to ensure that these things don't keep repeating themselves. However, as you well know also, insurgency is such that it's difficult to manage because they strike at the most unexpected places and time and circumstance. Therefore, you cannot possibly predict adequately and accurately at all times. But otherwise, ECOWAS stands to not only condemn this, but take every step necessary to ensure that it doesn't repeat itself.
Finally, what is the message of ECOWAS to the people of Burkina Faso at this hour?
Well, for the people of Burkina Faso, ECOWAS truly stands by them, and they should be assured that at all times, ECOWAS will be available and there to assist. For those who must have lost their lives, it is an undeserved sympathy. And for those who probably have been injured, we also wish them speedy recovery. But surely, ECOWAS stands by them at all times in matters like this. Just like has been demonstrated clearly during the recently concluded elections in that country, you could see the role of ECOWAS in bringing peace, prosperity, and progress.
Haruna Wakane is a spokesman for ECOWAS. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari this week announced the country would investigate the 2014 mass kidnapping of schoolgirls from the northeastern town of Chibok by Boko Haram militants. But advocates for the missing students' release are skeptical about how much a probe can accomplish nearly 2 years after they were taken. Garba Shehu, spokesman for President Buhari, told me the government is working hard to ensure the abducted schoolgirls are rescued and brought home to their parents.
This request to open a new investigation into it was instructed by the demand of the Office of the National Security Advisor, who made the request and the president approved it on the basis of what they are looking at, because you know they are involved in a lot of investigations on so many things in the country now over the past 2 years. So apparently they have been seeing things that probably needed to be looked into. But there is also a convergence in the fact that when the parents of the girls came to Abuja, to the presidency, they came with a number of allegations concerning the whereabouts of those girls. Some of them openly saying that they knew this person or that person connected with the organized kidnap or all of that. So therefore, I think that that sense that that thing had not been properly looked into, and that somebody had, you know, to do this for the country.
How did the meeting of the president and the parents of the abducted girls go? Because some of them said they were disappointed that the president did not connect with them and that he just spoke with them and left them.
He had to leave. He had to leave because this was an ongoing meeting. The president was advised of the need to put up an appearance. His ministers had started this meeting. He came in and he made his intervention. And he left after he finished. He could not have ended a meeting if himself did not start. When he left, the ministers continued the meeting because the thing hadn't come to a closure. So it must be understood that this is a proper meeting procedure. If you have a part to play and you come in and you do your part, you go. You don't say that the meeting should break because you have done your own part. There were more things to do, and the ministers waited. They didn't even see the president off. They waited to conclude the meeting before they broke.
So what assurances did Mr. President give to the parents, particularly when it comes to bringing them back, as they anticipate the president will do for them?
The assurances he gave of continuing the effort, the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, everybody is doing to secure those girls and bring them home safely. The president, if he disappointed anyone, he didn't lie to them. Because that's not the president we have. What they wanted to hear was for the president to say, I have the girls, they're in location A, B, all of them, 219, sitting in one place, waiting to be brought home. The president didn't have that information. Unfortunately, he would say the truth as it is, and that's what he told them. We are making 100% effort. 100% effort to secure your girls, but as it is, we don't have absolute information about their data.
What is currently the fight against the Boko Haram militant in their last stronghold, which is the Sambisa Forest? What is the latest development on that front?
Well, the army has acquired new equipment to clear, you know, the landmines that have been planted in order to pave way, you know, for the fighters to go, to move forward. You know that the forest has been heavily mined by the terrorists, and many of those who even left the mines, either fled or have been killed in the course of this fight. So the Boko Haram themselves are falling victim to the mines that have been planted by their own fellows, by their own men, because nobody has an idea of how much of this is lying on the ground. So we have equipment that is helping to clear the way, and soon, very soon, hopefully, we'll be able to secure, take over the Sambisa Forest.
Garba Shehu is the spokesman for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. South Sudan's former Vice President, Dr. Riek Machar, has recalled the leadership of his team for consultations after accusing President Salva Kiir of sabotaging the full implementation of the latest agreement signed in Ethiopia. He has since petitioned heads of state in the region and called on the international community to put pressure on the government in Juba to prevent the administration from undermining the accord. Ezekiel Lolgatko, the Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the South Sudan's People's Liberation Movement in opposition, told me that the government's refusal to abide by the terms of the agreement is creating unease and tension.
We are stuck. They have reached a deadlock because of the 28 states. Salva Kiir has decided not to implement the agreement in the letters and spirit. So we have decided that since the National Constitution Amendment Committee and the leadership of the advanced team is not having any headway, and the government is not revoking their decision on the 28 states, and they want all the parties to violate the agreement so that we actually adopt the 28 states that they have proposed. The chairman of the SPLM-SPLA, Dr. Riek Machar Teng, has decided today that he will recall only the leadership of the advance team, 12 people in Juba who are members of the political bureau, plus the chairman himself and the whole entire leadership. We are 25. We will meet in Pagak, South Sudan, to decide on the next course of action, what we needed to do.
Has your group officially petitioned former President Festus Mohai to register your protest? Because it appears the refusal to send or name your ministers as part of the unity government proposed in the agreement basically has failed before it even started.
That is true, because now, technically, if you are going to form a government, you must have a constitution in place first. And then when you have the constitution, then now you can form the government by appointing the vice president and the first vice president and the ministers. And then from there, and all the constitutional post holders. And then from there, now you swear them in using this new constitution that we are working on. And we have actually reached a deadlock on it. So you cannot actually use the whole constitution that is not reflecting the peace agreement that we have signed in August last year.
Refusing to name your side of ministerial appointment into a unity government, don't you think partly funds the destabilization of the full implementation of the peace agreement signed last year, instead of registering your protest not only to Festus Mohai, who leads the mediation effort, as well as the regional group IGAD?
Well, we have written Chairman Dr. Riek Machar Teng, the former Vice President of the Republic of South Sudan, who is the leader of the SPLM-SPLA in opposition, has written a letter to the President, President Mohai, copied to the regional leaders of IGAD, the AU, the European Union, the Troika, and the UN Secretary General, saying that we need to implement the agreement as it is. And the agreement is saying 10 states, not 28 states. So we are actually basically telling the world and the international community that let us implement the agreement as it is. But President Silva is saying, let us, you know, work outside the agreement by creating 28 states. That is actually creating the destabilization selecting or actually nominating our ministers to the transitional government, they are ready. Dr. Machar has finished the process of the preparation and the process of selecting his ministers who will be serving the SPLM, SPLA-IO in the transitional government. They are ready. Everything is ready.
After you meet today, what's next for you?
Well, we will meet and see what we will do, because we are actually calling JMAC, Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, the Secretary General, the regional leaders, and the Troika, and the European Union and China, to act in defending the agreement. Because if we start violating it from the start, then now what is the fate of the next 3 years? Then definitely you will be violating and violating, and that will actually even encourage others, for example, like us. That will encourage us to even violate it more and more. But we are not going to do that. We are basically saying President Salva and his party, the SPLM in government, to make sure that the agreement is implemented. Because South Sudanese, they need peace. They don't need us to quarrel over issues that are not part of the agreement or that are not in the agreement. We just wanted to make sure that we move forward and deliver services to the people of South Sudan.
Ezekiel Lol Gatkoth, Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition. He spoke with me from Gambela in Ethiopia. Zambia's President Edgar Lungu has directed members of the governing Patriotic Front Party, or PF, to avoid commenting on issues of tribalism. His comments were made after Information Minister Chisimba Kambwili was quoted as saying people in some part of Zambia would not vote for Jesus even if he were to compete against somebody that they've been voting for during elections. Father Frank Bwalya, deputy spokesman for the PF, told me that voting patterns in last year's presidential vote showed deep-seated regional and tribal sentiments.
Well, in this country, for some time now, people have been talking about the tribalism and regionalism that emerged last year in January during the presidential election, which we had after the death of President Michael Chirufya-Sata. Following the appearing of our chief government spokesperson on a program on ZNBC, which is our public broadcaster, where he said that a certain region in our country would not vote for Jesus if he stood against somebody that they've been voting for. So that attracted a lot of a sharp reaction. And I think in the wake of that, our president had a chat with me and said to me, this tribal talk should stop. However, the president did not say our members should not engage in tribal talk or in tribalism. What he said was that our members should stop commenting on issues of tribalism.
Why now? And what is he going to do about it since he's still the president?
The president has been very clear, categorical about his position against tribalism in our country, and he has continued to call upon all Zambians to desist from engaging in anything or making any statements that would be divisive, that would be understood as tribal. But in his wisdom, he thinks that it is the right time to send a strong warning to PF members to ensure that they don't comment on tribalism. Because our members are being accused of accusing other people of tribalism, even when what they say is not necessarily accusing other people of tribalism, but simply condemning tribalism because it is a vice that should be condemned.
Why do you think tribalism catches on so well in Zambia? And politicians, as you have said, sometimes appear to be taking advantage of that because that is how they can converse vote. What are the parties themselves, including yours, the PF, jointly coming together to ensure this is not further to undermine the country's togetherness or unity?
It is a subject over which many people in this country and some political parties would not have the courage to confront because of their history, because of how they have tried to use tribalism to their advantage. On the other side, as a party, we have no problem talking about tribalism. Nevertheless, the president has directed that we should not, because it is generating very unhealthy and in many cases, very heated debate. So the president thinks it is not healthy and we should stop it.
Zambia has the civic organization and civil society organizations that, if empowered, could educate the Zambian masses to ensure that it reduces such hate speeches or tribalism. Why hasn't the PF government, and for that matter other political parties, joined this call for a mass education campaign to lessen the effect of this tribal or hate speeches?
On our part as PF, we have never counted on tribalism as a mechanism or a system to win elections, and we have been in the forefront condemning it and urging all Zambians for Zambians to condemn it. Other civil society organizations, for reasons best known to themselves, have aligned themselves and fashioned their messages in a manner that clearly shows that they have no problem with tribalism. And I want to believe that the president is putting his foot down not only to members of the governing party in terms of urging them not to make any comment on tribalism, but also for all Zambians to realize that this is a very unproductive undertaking, and with him promoting one Zambia, one nation, that everyone should come on board and promote what is common about our people. It is the one Zambia, one nation.
Father Frank Bwalya is the deputy spokesman for the Zambian ruling Patriotic Front Party. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Women living in a sprawling displaced people's camp in the Central African Republic's capital, Bangui, say they are increasingly harassed and sometimes raped by people who claim are anti-Balaka militia seeking to intimidate them for trading with Muslims. For VOA, Katerina Hoye reports Human Rights Watch documented several cases of rape and sexual assault last year around the camp.
It is yet another busy market day in Pikasank, the last remaining Muslim enclave in the Central African Republic's capital, Bangui. Farmer and businesswoman Philomene Pata has been coming to the market to sell her goods for as long as she can remember. But recently, such visits have become increasingly dangerous for her and other women who live in the Mpoko displaced persons camp at the Bangui airport. She says in bringing her produce to the market, the anti-Balaka, the mostly Christian militia, would take her phone, her money and goods. She says sometimes she would be beaten and told, "This will teach you not to bring food to the Muslims." While the security situation in Bangui has improved somewhat in recent months, some neighborhoods are still under militia control. One area of the Mpoko camp is controlled by a militia leader known as Emar Engafai. Some aid agencies have suspended their work in the camp because of the volatile situation. Last month, at least 10 men, some of them armed, stormed and looted the hospital run by Doctors Without Borders in the camp. Leaving for the market, women are constantly harassed by the anti-Balaka militia, says Blandina, the president of a women's association in the camp. Now says the men kidnap the women as they leave the camp and rape them. She adds it happens all the time, but especially during the night. Sometimes the men let the women go when they are done, says Na. And sometimes they only release them after their families pay a ransom. She has met dozens of rape victims in the camp. Many of the women lost their husbands when the Seleka rebels attacked Bangui in December 2013. They have had a hard time supporting their families. Now says the women have no work and are struggling. She says some of them are sleeping with men outside the camp for money. When they return, the militia inside the camp kidnap and rape them. During 2 weeks in December, Human Rights Watch documented at least 25 acts of sexual violence in Bangui. The number is likely much higher. Because of the social stigma, many of the cases are never reported. The organization also documented at least 5 cases where women and girls were raped by Muslim self-defense groups, some who are conducting revenge attacks against Christian and animist neighborhoods near their enclave. The International Criminal Court has been conducting investigations in the car. A special criminal court set to start working this year could help address crimes including sexual violence and provide justice for the victims. Meanwhile, the estimated 20,000 people at the Mpoku camp remain largely unprotected, as UN peacekeepers and French forces, known as Sangarés, do not provide security. Katerina Höye for VOA News, Bangui.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Kote, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
When you see a woman with a bishika, you don't know. Are you ready now? Let me go, show them. Show them. Mr. Flame of Fire!
Your beauty making me to realize. Zaga. Shake body.
I'm going crazy. Oh, let me be
maga. I want to be your maga. Your lover. Baby, please give me. Oh. I'm going crazy. Oh, let me be your maga. Your maga. I want to be your maga. Your lover. Tell me what you want. Oh, oh, oh. Hey. I just wanna know your need. Cause the way you dey touch the body, I like the way you dey do the body. Make me want to dey gummy body, dey gummy body.
Ha, okay.
Eh? Oh yeah, the popo. Baby, let me go the popo. Ah. Oh yeah, the popo. Eh? Baby, let me go the popo. Oh, she go the popo. So let me go the popo. Oh yeah, tonight. Oh tonight. Baby, please give me. I want to be your maga. Your lover. Baby, please give me. I'm going crazy. Oh, let me be your maga. Your maga. I want to be your maga.
I said,
your lover. There is something about this, your body, where they make me the jolly. When I see you, my baby, I just like you happy. Oh, 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 my baby. You dey sweet me, oh, 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 my baby. Tonight, oh, yeah, limpopo.
Baby, let me go limpopo.
What?
Oh, yeah, limpopo. Baby, let me go limpopo.
Okay.
Oh, she go limpopo. So let me go limpopo.
Oh, yeah. Tonight. Oh, tonight. Oh. Baby, please give me. I want to be your maga. Your lover. Baby, please give me. I'm going crazy. Hey, let me be your maga. Let me be your maga. I want to be your maga. Your lover.
Africa lady, oh.
Aye.
I sing in the song for Panya.
Aye.
And I dance in the dance for Panya, oh. I would do anything for Panya.
Anything, yeah.
And I thank you the Lord for Panya,
hey. Aye, what is my baby name?
Panya, Panya, Panya.
Aye, what is your baby name?
Panya, Panya,
Panya. Anything,
yeah.
I request for my baby girl.
Panya,
scatter the fluff for me.
Panya, Panya, oh, Panya.
Hey, hey, hey.
sweet like a chocolate. When she come around, she a heavyweight. She a dance, she a move, immediate. Baby, I am.
Aya, what is my baby name? Aya, what is your baby name? I request for my baby girl. Panya scatter the floor for me.
And I thank you the Lord for Panya. Too much love I have for you.
Abi,
hey.
Aya, what is my baby name? Aya, what is your baby name?
Music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It is always a pleasure for me to share with my colleagues who are working with the Voice of America. Every passing week, I pay close attention to U.S. policy towards Africa. I also look at African opinions on an attitude toward the United States. This week, a very important event occurred within the United States, primarily for Americans, but also for the world. That event was the State of the Union, delivered by President Barack Hussein Obama. This speech, historians are going to say, will be remembered by human beings who are looking at America in the 21st century, because Barack Hussein Obama's election to the United States was unprecedented, and his final State of the Union takes us back to the founding father of the United States, George Washington. Washington left a legacy, gave his final message to the American nation at a very critical moment. At that time, America was a young republic, a revolutionary development in world history, which is now remembered for more than 200 years. Marking America as a republic, I have said this in many other places, the American Revolution was an attempt to reproduce in human society serious efforts by other men in history, particularly within the European experience, who try to create a republic. It is not an easy job. It is a very difficult task. It is part of the human experience to govern oneself without having someone governing you in terms of a political culture, political theology, and political economy defined by human beings looking up into the heavens, hoping that some heavenly body is governing them through his decree, by human beings accepting what some European politicians and scholars call divine confirmation of rulership. The American Revolution was a radical departure from that narrative. Human beings living on this planet were paying closer attention to the fact that there is a heavenly creator, and they move on to create a government which will be defined differently by the 44 presidents of the United States, beginning with George Washington, and that American narrative will be remembered by the Declaration of Independence, by the Constitution of the United States, and the collective experiences of all Americans who came from the Revolution to the establishment of the Republic. This past week, that long history was dramatized once again on the American political stage by the appearance of a young man whose father came from Kenya, whose mother came from white America, and you have a very revolutionary development in world history. I have said it in many other places before, when he was elected, how history in its various ways of ironies and paradoxes, telling human beings in the making of history. President Obama's State of the Union is being debated by his supporters and by his opponents. And that debate is going to be here, just like the departure of George Washington created controversies, but also powerful insights. And now he is immortalized because there is a standing monument in his honor in the national capital, the George Washington Memorial. Barack Hussein Obama is going to be remembered by America. That's the way it is today with regard to Barack Hussein Obama and his last State of the Union.
Thank you, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineers for today, Nick Ivanov and John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the person who asks for the meaning of a proverb has called his or her mother's dowry a waste. I'm your host, Peter Clotin in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Local communities are the key to turning the tide against terrorism.
Whether in France, Turkey, or the United States, said Undersecretary of State for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell, militaries and intelligence agencies can protect us from external threats and bring terrorists to justice, but they cannot address the complex motives and hateful ideologies that drive people to terrorism in the first place. Real progress against terrorism requires not only eliminating terrorists, but also disrupting the process by which people become terrorists. Only a broader and more holistic approach can ensure that new recruits don't join the ISIL battlefield. The United States has promoted this broader approach to tackling terrorism at home and abroad under the mantle of Countering Violent Extremism, or CVE, which recognizes that empowered communities are among the best antidotes for preventing the spread of terrorist ideologies. The first step to implementing a holistic approach is to ensure that public officials at home and abroad uphold the rule of law and respect for human rights. When governments fail to protect, respect, and serve all their people, it creates openings that terrorists eagerly exploit. According to the Global Terrorism Index, 92% of all terrorist attacks over the last 25 years occurred in countries where state-sponsored violence, such as torture and political imprisonment, was widespread. Second, said Ambassador Sewell, public officials must build trust with local leaders and communities. From Afghanistan to Somalia to Colombia, research shows that when populations are marginalized and supporting institutions are absent, communities become more vulnerable to violent extremism. But when locals know what to look for and whom to call to protect friends and family from radical ideologies, and when they trust authorities to help them, those ideologies struggle to take root. As the terrorist threat posed by the Islamic State continues to grow, partnerships with Muslim communities at home and abroad are more critical than ever. As President Barack Obama has said, ISIL does not speak for Islam, and Muslims around the world are our greatest allies in debunking perversions of their faith. In the long run, the way to defeat groups like ISIL is to promote democratic values and strong communities.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.